You know, every time, and you'll get lots of opportunity, the New Testament uses family language to talk about church, to say that will involve those of us who are younger valuing the older generation, listening to their wisdom, that will involve those who are married with kids deliberately inviting single people into that family, not just as a one-off, but trying to develop a depth of relationship there.
Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name is Adrian Reynolds. I'm the head of national ministries for the FIEC, and I'm here today with Andy Robinson. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Adrian. Really good to be with you.
You've come from Oxford today. You, until recently, were pastor of Woodstock Road Evangelical Church in Oxford.
Yeah, Woodstock Road Baptist.
Oh, sorry, Woodstock Road Baptist right. Church. It is evangelical, isn't it? Just checking.
It was when I was pastor. was there for 19 years. I'm a northerner at heart, actually, so I was a pastor rather than a pastor.
Where are you from originally?
Born in Manchester.
So, Manchester, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So is Oxford as far south as you've been?
It does feel very southern at times,
does it?
Oxford. Yeah.
You'd enjoy a Market Harborough train station because if you go on one side of the train station, it says trains to the south, the south. So I think actually Market Harborough is in the north. Don't write in. I know it's not in the north.
It really isn't.
Anyway, enough of that frivolity. You're not there now. You're doing something else. So you're doing two things. Tell us what you fill your time with, Andy.
Yeah, so 3 days a week I work as the training director for the South Central Gospel Partnership. So lead a ministry training course for about 60 or so in Oxford. And then 2 days a week, work as the training director for Living Out, speaking to issues of faith and sexuality.
Right. And it's in Root Heart, Root Health, that you told me the ministry training course. 60 is a good number, and people wanting to learn and grow, that's really exciting.
Yeah, I'm really encouraged by it, particularly the range of ages that we get. So we get a number of folk in their young early 20s, interns at churches or with parachurch organizations, and then they often get mixed up with a lot of people early retired wanting to use their retirement to serve in the church. And so just love the synthesis of those two age groups coming together. They form the bulk of the course.
Well, we're here today to talk about how the church cares for singles. I guess a lot of those people on the ministry training course at the younger end will be single themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're going to think a little bit about how the church cares for singles. I've just got 1 Peter 5 here open. The context for that, I think, is, to the elders among you, Peter writes, I appeal as a fellow elder and a witness of Christ's sufferings, who will also share in the glory to be revealed. Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, watching over them. And it strikes me that a lot of our caring for God's flock is very family orientated. We love families. We celebrate families in perhaps a way that we think the world doesn't. Mm. We celebrate marriage. We celebrate children. But actually, we've got to be careful, haven't we, that we are watching over the entirety of the flock. Tell us a little bit about some of the things we need to watch out for as leaders as we try and think about caring for the entirety of God's people.
Yeah, I mean, it's recognizing that people will be in different situations, and there can be a tendency to undervalue what single people can bring to the church. Somebody made the point that often churches will pray, we could really do with 2 or 3 new families, whereas you very rarely hear the sort of, it'd be really great to pray for 6 single people to arrive. And so one of the dangers...
I'm convicted about that already. That is exactly how I pray. So I'm sorry. That's wrong, isn't it? So, and what are we doing there? Are we saying subconsciously, you're not doing it, I'm doing it. So I'm confessing my sin. Am I subconsciously saying that I think families have more value, or what's going on, do you think, when we do that?
Okay, so there will be good things going on in that, in as much as churches will want to train the next generation. There's a thrill in seeing children, teenagers living for the Lord and so on. And yeah, of course we want to do that. That's great. But there can be a sense in which that's a more valuable way of living, or somehow the goal, the aspiration for Christians should be to get to that family stage. Whereas singleness can feel like a transition stage that we hope people get past. Mm. And I think some of that is lying behind the comments that we make.
Okay. So almost we're reducing single people in some of the things we might say and do to a kind of second class status. We wouldn't express it like that, but that's how it feels. That's actually how it is in some ways.
Yeah. So if, funnily enough, a few months ago, I found myself talking about somebody being still single and then immediately hating myself afterwards. Right. Because I get it, it's just the language of still single. Hopefully they will get beyond that. In a way that does feel the opposite to the New Testament, which seems to view singleness really positively. And so some of the language we can use can be a giveaway, whether it's still single, whether it's regarding married partners as our other half, as though, you know, to be single is just half a person waiting completion. Yep. Or whether it's some of the ambitions that we can have. So interestingly, talking to parents, obviously their ambition will often be, you know, really keen to see their children married and set up with ideally a Christian partner. Yeah. Just some of the language that we use, some of the ambitions that we've got, possibly betray a degree of marriage is best, singleness is second class. And so then we'll pray for families to come and join the church rather than single people.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I don't think, certainly in my experience and sort of searching my own heart, I don't think people are sort of consciously going out and trying to create differences.
Yeah, absolutely.
But actually we do create this kind of idealized life. I think you're exactly right. That runs through our parenting, doesn't it? You know, actually when our children are young, we want them to do really well in exams. That's the most important thing to parents. And then when they get older, we want them to say marry a Christian and have children. That's the next most important thing. And I mean, in some ways, when you sort of read through the pages of the New Testament, they're bizarre goals, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're kind of slightly skewed away from what the Bible wants for them, which is to confess Christ, to be following him and giving themselves to him. And as you say, the New Testament does have a positive view of singleness. Just unpack that for us a little bit.
So you've also got Jesus himself, who is a wonderful example of singleness. And then
and people forget that.
Well, indeed, absolutely. And then in Matthew 19, when Jesus talks about marriage being male, female, and the disciples are slightly nervous by how narrow Jesus' sexual ethics seem to be, you come back and say, well, maybe it's better not to marry. And to be honest, whenever I do a talk on singleness and people come to that conclusion, I sort of backtrack and say, whoa, I've gone too far. Whereas Jesus almost doubles down and says, well, yeah, actually, some people will be eunuchs born that way, made that way. Yeah. Some people will for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. And so in Matthew 19, you've got Jesus giving great dignity to those who are single. Again, Paul, another single man, 1 Corinthians 7, will sort of say, I wish all of you were as I am. And again, I think Paul's expectation in 1 Corinthians 7 is that the majority will marry, but he says there are great advantages in singleness. And you could almost make the case that Paul would argue that singleness may bring greater benefits to the local church.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so both in Matthew 19 and 1 Corinthians 7, you just see singleness regarded really positively.
Okay. Let's think a little bit about how we've got to here before we think about how we get out of it. I wonder, let's see what you think of this, that we've been slightly seduced into thinking that the family is the building block of the New Testament. Now, in the Old Testament, I think that's clearly right.
Yeah.
Where does teaching happen primarily? Well, it happens in the family.
Yeah.
And families, of course, would have been large probably and extended. But where does teaching happen? It happens in the family. What is the blessing? It's the blessing of family, isn't it, in the Old Testament? I think in the New Testament, that becomes fulfilled, first of all, in Christ, and then in Christ's family.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that certainly my theology is that the building block of the New Testament is Jesus' family, not my family. And I wonder if we've lost that subtlety. Is that a fair criticism?
I think that's right. I think I would probably be less generous and say our problem hasn't been a theological one, but simply importing from culture a sense of finding the romantic other is the main goal in life.
I think you're
being more generous than I would be, actually. But to pick up the point you were running with, so Jesus redefines family. So there's the moment where he's told, you know, your brother and your mother are outside, it's Mark 3, and he would redefine it and say to his disciples, you know, here are my mother and my brothers. Similarly, I think that's what's going on at the cross when Jesus sees his mother and Cypele loves, you know, here's your mother, here's your son, I think is Jesus redefining family, actually, rather than just being nice to his mum. And so he's saying the cross introduces a whole new family dynamic. And of course, we know the children of Abraham are those who have the faith of Abraham. And that's so using that language indicates that family is not going to be simply nuclear family, blood family, as it were, but will be those who share the same faith.
And Jesus is everlasting father. I mean, that's the sort of bit of the Isaiah prophecy that people just slightly gloss over.
Sure.
But then you get Isaiah work through in Hebrews 2.
Yeah.
You know, here I am, says Jesus to the Father, and the children you have given me.
Yeah.
So actually Jesus is, he's not Father God, obviously, but he is the head of the new family. And I think those sort of Psalms that speak about children being a reward, Psalm 127, for example, seems to me best seen fulfilled in Christ and the way that the Father gives children to the Son. And that's how the family grows.
And the New Testament is just awash with family language. So the church is the household of God. You were the language of brothers, sisters. Timothy is Paul's son in the faith. You know, it's just awash with family language.
Yeah.
To be honest, way more than the New Testament talks about physical family. Yes. Of course the New Testament does talk about physical family.
We believe in community, not communes.
Yes.
Is that a good way of putting
it? That's right.
That actually there are instructions for parents, there are instructions for children. So clearly the family is a thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Highly valued and to be rejoiced in, but not to be rejoiced in exclusively compared to any other form of relationship.
So the language I would use quite a lot is the Christian is part of two families. That would just be, I think, useful language to hold on to. So responsibility to nuclear family and particularly actually to elderly parents, for instance, that's still there. But the fact that family language is used again and again for the church means I don't think we can do a strong nuclear family always trumps church family.
No. So, I mean, sometimes you hear people say, the dad is the pastor of the family. I don't think that's right. I think the pastor of the family, just to get northern for a minute, the pastor of the family is the pastor of the church, if the family are part of church, seems to me. I mean, there are, teaching goes on in the family, obviously. You know, we're to teach one another. There are those commands. But I don't think that's primary. It seems to me the community is really, really key. So let's just explore something you just pushed back on there a little bit, which is interesting, which is this isn't just a theological issue, it's a cultural issue for us in this moment. Just to say again what you said to me just now.
Well, I suspect the main driver for preferring sort of marriage over singleness is, in a sense, the great cultural sense you have that the key goal in life is to find the romantic
other. It's rom-com
world. It's rom-com, absolutely. And then what we tend to do is a sort of Christianized version of rom-com.
Yep.
And so we see marriage threatened in different ways, and so we want to defend marriage. And so we do a sort of Christianized version of rom-com to say, the goal isn't to find the perfect romantic relationship. The goal is to find the perfect marriage. And that's to become a chief goal for Christian maturity. And that then can leave singles feeling in a sort of second-class position.
That's helpful. Now, we mustn't conflate single people into one group because there is different kinds of singleness, right? I'm just thinking in our own church, we've got people who are young singles. Perhaps one day we'd love to get married. Yeah. There'll be others who are not seeking marriage for various reasons. There'll be others who are divorced, some who are widowed. And actually, a single woman who's been widowed, for example, you'd want to care for them and look after them in a different, very different way from a single person who's 21, just coming straight out of university. Is there a danger? We say we've got marrieds and singles that we've already identified. We don't think enough about how we care for singles. But if we do, we kind of think, let's say a prayer for singles.
Yeah.
We're not really thinking about the flock at that point, are we?
Sure. Completely. And even within my own lifespan, singleness as a 25-year-old is quite different to singleness now as a 46-year-old.
Never, Andy.
You would never have guessed, would you, Adrian?
46?
I'm now at the stage where I have to do the maths. But anyway. Funnily enough, was speaking yesterday to somebody who's been bereaved in the last few weeks, and you know, just aware of in her case, just the pain of deeply missing somebody in a way that actually is, in my experience as a singleness, that's never really been the case.
Sure. Yeah.
Which means there's a whole heap of different pastoral issues around singleness.
Mm. How I'll ask you a personal question. Mm. Don't feel you have to answer it if you don't want to. But over those years of being a single guy in church, I know you've often been the pastor, so perhaps it doesn't quite cash out in the same way. But what has helped you? How have people, other church leaders, cared for you well?
Yeah.
Tell us some good examples.
I mean, the best examples are those who've deliberately included me within their family. That's been by far and away the most useful thing. Sometimes that's been the sort of, you know, once every 18 months come around for lunch thing, which is lovely. Largely, it's where those friendships have gone deep. So I've probably got five or six different people in my mind where they've deliberately incorporated me into their family life. So in my case, they're probably now spread all over the country, but they're constantly on to me to say, when are you next here? When are you coming round? When can you come and stay? There's a depth of friendship there, which means I know them pretty well. They know pretty much there is to know about me. So probably those who've prioritized friendship are those who've helped me most. Or funnily enough, I was just chatting to a single friend of mine, a bit younger than me, probably on the way towards marriage. And he took the initiative to say, I'm aware the friendship might look different when I'm married, but just to say this friendship really matters to me, I've got every intention of it carrying on. Yeah. So those kind of things where people have looked beyond, as it were, their nuclear family to say, how can we wrap another church family member into a sense of family, that's been deeply precious to me.
Help us out here, Andy. I guess many churches are starting from scratch, let's be honest. And perhaps most churches, average church size in the FIC, kind of medium-ish sized church, you know, 70 to 110, 120 within that sort of bracket.
Yeah.
So churches don't have huge resources to deploy. We might read things on a, you know, American church website where they have a pastor for singles or a pastor for 20-year-olds. You know, we haven't got the capacity and resources to do that. So I'm starting from scratch. Mm. Okay, so talk to me as a fellow leader, Christchurch Harborough. I've already heard some really helpful counsel and critique, which is I've got to be careful with words. That's important, right?
Sure.
And actually, we think about that with lots of other areas of life. Why wouldn't we think about that?
Yeah.
So I've got to be careful with words. What other things could I do as a church leader to encourage our church to be a caring place for singles?
I think two or three main goals. One would be, one's a thought, theological thing, of saying, I want in all the language I use and the way I teach to talk about marriage and singleness as equally good gifts. Mm-hmm. So trying to avoid any sense that the goal of life is to get married. So the goal of life ultimately is to get married as part of the church to Jesus, but the goal in this life is to prepare for that ultimately. Yeah. So that partly just being clear on that theologically.
And just on that, there's a helpful kind of warning there, isn't there? Because we're trying hard to set out a stall for a Bible view of marriage. We feel we have to speak clearly and loudly about that, and often because of the pressure that there is in the culture, whether that's to do with wrong definitions of marriage or whether that's to do with cohabitation. So we feel we're fighting that. So we're speaking loudly and clearly about marriage.
Yeah.
And the danger is that becomes an imbalance.
Yeah.
So we've got to be thinking about that, haven't we?
Yeah, and so I'm absolutely convinced churches need to argue for a biblical definition of marriage. What I would say is when you argue for a biblical definition of marriage, you always want to add a sentence or two to say, and actually singleness is a good calling in Scripture as well. And so I would always want to add that sentence whenever I'm talking about marriage in any context, is to say, and we also affirm the godly choice to live a celibate
They're both gifts, aren't they, in 1 Corinthians 7?
Yeah,
they both have gift language attached
that's
to them.
That's right. Yeah. And so whenever you talk about marriage, a sentence or two about singleness is always just a useful thing to have in our heads.
Yeah.
But in terms of the wider question, I think it's just equipping church family to be church family. So don't, in fact, please don't set up a ministry for single people. I'm not entirely convinced that's particularly helpful. part of me would just be teaching.
Well, especially if you're putting all those different kinds of people in one group who have got very different needs. Yeah.
No, it would feel slightly strange, I think. So what I would be saying is I would be, you know, every time, and you get lots of opportunity, the New Testament uses family language to talk about church, to say that will involve those of us who are younger, valuing the older generation, listening to their wisdom. That will involve those who are married with kids, deliberately inviting single people into that family, not just as a one-off, but trying to develop a depth of relationship there. So part of me says it's not hugely difficult. There's not going to be a huge ramp up of any kind of ministry here.
Church being church.
Just church being church. Yeah. So that works across generations, across nationalities, across marital status. We want to be coming together and creating lots of informal but deep friendships across all those different lines.
Have we not been helped, do you think, by wanting to get the Bible into everything we do? That could be selectively misquoted and be really unhelpful. I think you know what I'm trying to say, that actually every meeting, everything has to be a Bible study or a sermon or an expository message of some kind. We often don't allow enough room just for hanging out with people. And actually that does us a disservice at this point, doesn't it? Because if that's all we're doing, there isn't the social space and time actually for people to, well, for all kinds of people to spend time with each other, actually for young and old to spend time with each other, for singles and marrieds and families to spend time with each other, for, you know, it works at all kinds of levels, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it is. And, you know, God is the God who's given us multiple things for us to enjoy. And so we're allowed
to
enjoy.
You're making a case for a wine and cheese evening, are you? Or for beer tasting. You're from Manchester. A beer tasting evening.
Beer and rugby. Yeah.
Is that rugby league? Or don't answer that question.
We're going down a tangent here. Yeah. I think we just need to enjoy food and sport and music together. But as that happens, to want friendships to develop. So the thing that's most useful for me as a single person is to have a handful of people who know me and who I know at a reasonably deep level. I'm always struck by the way Jesus defines friendship. So when Jesus describes his disciples as friends in John 15, he says, "I call you friends because a servant doesn't know his master's business, but everything that comes from the Father I've made known to you." I mean, that's quite a profound statement about our relationship with Jesus. Yeah. But in passing, it's an interesting definition of friendship. A friendship is somebody you reveal stuff to. Yeah. And so what I would want for single people is to have a number of friendships within the church whereby they have felt a safe place to disclose some of the struggles of life, maybe including singleness, and that's been reciprocated by the other single people or the families they're talking to. And so as well as the hanging out thing, I suspect a really useful thing to help single people is to develop a deeper culture of friendship and honesty within the church so people are known
and know
each other.
So actually we've got to move away from this idea, speaking as someone who's married, people who say, well, my best friend and probably my only friend in the church is my spouse. I'm sorry, don't get me wrong. That's a great place to start, my best friend.
Yes.
You'd hope that you'd be revealing things and talking honestly about stuff. But actually, as a bloke, if my only friend in the church is my spouse, I'm missing out on the depth and the wonder of friendship in the church, and also missing out on serving others, including singles. It's not a single married issue. It's actually it's a deeper issue about we've got to value friendship.
Absolutely. I think fine for your spouse to be your best friend. But I suppose if they're your only friend, you really don't want to get in problems with your marriage because where'd you go?
Yes, that's quite a negative way of thinking about it. Yes, I'm with you.
But
how do you learn? I mean, speaking as a husband, right? How do I learn how to be a better husband? Well, my wife might correct me. And perhaps she does. But actually, I want to talk to other blokes. You know, how do I learn to be a better bloke? I want to talk to other blokes in the church. So actually, if I haven't got those friendships, it's going to be detrimental for me in terms of my discipleship.
Yeah, absolutely. And put puts immense pressure on the spouse to be the one who provides everything that we need in terms of our human relationships, which I don't think is ever, I don't think that's ever intended to be the case, given we're part of two families. And so for all of us, married and single, how do we, partly is how do we invest the time, but also how do we go into relationships with the goal of an openness that creates a deeper sense of friendship? I think would help all of us. It would certainly help those who are single.
Do we need to think about this? I mean, there's things that we can be doing there as part of church life. Does there also need to be an intentionality? I think once, when you're starting from a low point, or when you've not done things perhaps as you ought to have done, as I ought to have done in terms of language and things like that, is there some correcting that's needed? I'm very struck by John Piper's book on marriage, This Momentary Marriage, as he, I guess is a book for couples, especially for those perhaps getting married. There is a chapter on making singles part of your life.
Yeah.
But it sticks out in that book because it's the only one that does it. And, for whatever else you think about that book, isn't that extraordinary? There's an intentionality right from the outset about thinking, how am I going to serve all kinds of people in the church?
Yeah.
And I wonder if we've, in order to regain some momentum, we have got to do more than just try and be more careful with our words.
Yeah, definitely. And even the title of that book, This Momentary Marriage, makes the point that, in a sense, the church family, that's going to last into eternity, actually in a way that our human marriages won't in quite the same way. And so, again, there's just an interesting theological point going on there. Part of me wouldn't want us to beat ourselves up too much, in as much as I think many singles do find a church to be a place of deep family connection. So part of me wouldn't want to encourage a sort of counsel of utter despair on this.
Good. Thank you. That's a good corrective.
And for me, actually, my life has been vastly richer because of relationships within church family. So part of me wouldn't want to start with a counsel of despair. But would it be useful for an eldership team, every so often to reflect on the question, I wonder what it's like for a single person within the church? That's probably a useful discussion for an eldership team to have every couple of years. Or even, given lots of eldership teams are largely made up of those who are married, actually just to ask the question of the range of single people within the church, as you've mentioned, widowed, divorced, older single, younger single, just to ask the question, how are you finding, does this feel like family for you? And if not, why not? It'd be useful for eldership teams to have that conversation every so often.
There's perhaps another group of kind of singles in the church, which are those who are married to people who aren't believers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I wonder if it's perhaps a group we don't give much thought to, but there is a kind of, I realize it's not singleness in terms of, physical presence and those sorts of things. But in terms of spiritual connections,
absolutely,
it is a kind of singleness, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually there's a way that we've probably got experience in the church of people who have learned to find ways to cope with that and to deal with it and to flourish as a single person that could actually have a real benefit to people in those circumstances.
Yeah, definitely. And again, probably a group we can sometimes overlook. Preachers can be useful in this regard. So, sometimes I tried to drop things like that into sermons when I was a pastor. So, again, where you would have Jesus talking about sort of families being divided and so on, I just said, look, some of you are here, and actually you're the only Christian in your family, and you find that deeply painful. And simply to say you're in this text, Jesus knows about that.
That's really good.
And so to do stuff like that, just to show to people in that position, A, we notice you're in that position, but actually more importantly, Jesus speaks about people in that position. So partly preachers have got an opportunity to do good here. And actually, preachers have got an opportunity to do good in terms of singleness. So if you're just mentioning a list of suffering, for instance, for some of you, that will be a physical illness. For some of you, it's difficulty at work. For some, it will be involuntary singleness. Just mentioning stuff like that is how preachers can help. But also, how can we help those who are married to an unbeliever, or even actually often those with unbelieving children, there's just a deep pain in that.
Yeah.
It's probably something we should pray about more from the front. And again, just note that as a pain people will be struggling with. And again, just, you know, within a small group setting might be the most obvious setting, just actually to be checking, how's it going? Yeah. How can we pray? We do need to do that better.
So it's a great place. We're drawing to an end. It's a great place to end. Actually, the way those applications are worked out in the preaching or however you do them in church life, it's really, really important. Mm. And actually, all of us are most natural drawing applications that line up with our own experience.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the reality of any preaching ministry. And we've got to work hard and pray and be thoughtful, listen to voices to make sure that our applications are connecting with people where they are and not just generic, right? So the danger is I can get specific when it's things that are in my experience.
Mm.
But actually, when it's outside of that, I tend to generalizations because it just feels a bit safer.
Yeah.
Because actually, probably it reveals that I don't know other people as well as I should.
Yeah.
So it kind of feels safer ground. So I like the way you're doing that. I've got to be thinking about how does this resonate with the different people in the church and really try and connect it.
I mean, I didn't do this every week, but occasionally when I was a pastor and I was trying to think through application, I would be working around, I'd pick 10 or 11 people around the congregation, different stages in life and so on, and think, okay, what's the application to them? And obviously when I came to preach it, I didn't name them. But in a sense, it was working around my mind. Yeah,
you are thinking
mind.
Of Bob and Sue.
Yeah, and that's right. Yeah, and yeah. I needed that because otherwise I would never have made any applications into marriage. And I think that's just a healthy discipline. Yeah, Most of us haven't got the time to do it every week, but
and
every
actually,
so often.
If you're not doing that and not able to do that, that's saying something about your pastoral strategy, I might suggest. Yes. Pastor Andy, what is your favourite pastor, by the way?
Spaghetti, probably.
I couldn't help myself. Thank you so much for joining us. I found that really useful, actually. Things that have convicted me, just thinking, you know, the care that we must take over words actually in church, just how we're praying for people and praying about situations. That's really helpful. I found it really helpful. I hope you have too, if you're listening.
I've enjoyed being here.
Good. Thank you very much for joining us. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. Remember, you can rate us and review us, and that will help other people find us. So please do that if you can. And we'll join you again soon. Thanks very much.